morning and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines and the stories that make New Haven tick. WNHH's resident policing expert, retired assistant police chief, and current state senate sergeant-at-arms, John Bilecka, helps make New Haven tick. He's in the studio today to help us run down some of the recent criminal justice developments in our city, and he's joined by Harry Droz, WNHA station manager, resident Donald Trump fan, bravest man in New Haven, and he's going to help mix it up with John Luck as he always does. Welcome to the studio, guys.
Nice to be here, Paul.
Harry, good morning. How you doing, sir?
How you doing, Paul?
And Sam Hattleman, our intern, our brave intern, is man in the Facebook Live. Can I have where I can see the comments come up? Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. Well, guys, there's a lot of shenanigans over at 1 Union Avenue, police headquarters. We're in the matter of fact, on the third floor where John Bilecka used to have his office as the assistant police chief. Yeah. On the third floor is where the chief has his office. Then it's kind of sort of almost like a round, almost
right.
Like where you have the assistant chiefs all over in their suite.
The suite.
And then you have the center desks out in the open where the secretaries are. And I think William Shakespeare has been hired to script what's been going on up at that suite. There's been some kind of palace intrigue. And this week, and it's not just starting this week, but it came back out this week, where the new chief, Anthony Campbell, have for the second time, has ordered an internal investigation into the behavior of Assistant Chief Luis Casanova, who had been his rival, his chief rival, for the chief job. Now, this week was kind of murky. We only have some of the details. There's a story about it in New Haven Independent. I'm sure, John, you've heard other stuff. I've heard other stuff that you can't say till we know if it's accurate enough. Seems like there were some very interesting reports written by some of the cops who witnessed this, but we don't know what it says yet while the internal affairs investigation goes on. But as the assistant chief, Luis Casanova oversees the training academy. And there were three cops who, in separate incidents, were found to have violated search and seizure procedures. One of them is an officer who has kind of a history of these problems.
Right.
So Anthony Campbell, the chief, said, what we got to do is we got to send him for a couple days back to the training academy. There's obviously a concern here about how they conduct search and seizure. He said they weren't even bad traffic stops. That's what happened once the traffic stop started. So meanwhile, and this is where Mr. Shakespeare came in, the chief was out of town. I mean, he was sort of in and out of town on weekends, but he was in Boston for 3 weeks getting trained at the Police Executive Research Foundation, PERF.
Right.
And another assistant chief who is often in the mix of this stuff is away for months
right
down south getting Quantico, Virginia, getting FBI training. And Luis Casanova, the other assistant chief, was also in Boston getting a 3-week executive training course. And Chief Campbell authorized him to do that to help him be a better chief here, get another job somewhere else, buff up your skills. But they were not there the same exact 3 weeks. Casanova started 1 week earlier.
Right.
So in the third week of Chief Campbell's stay in Boston, Assistant Chief Casanova was back in New Haven, back at 1 Union Avenue.
Right.
So he's kind of charged the boss, not there, his old rival. So he goes back to training academy, and then these three cops show up for their quote-unquote discipline, which is to be retrained for a few days, how you do search and seizure and stuff. But apparently the Assistant Chief Casanova did not agree with this discipline. He said these are good cops that didn't do anything wrong. So he said he ordered the people below him at the training academy to change what would be the way those 2 days were run. So let them blow off some more steam at the firing range for a few hours, maybe made some kind of joke that some people said was a joke or not a joke. And all of a sudden, the people below him were faced with whom did they follow, the chief or the assistant chief. And when Chief Campbell came back, he got these reports and said he didn't discipline. We said our internal affairs should look into whether this is true, and in the meantime, Assistant Chief Casanova is confined to his desk in the chief suite, and he is not have responsible for training academy until this is finished. Partisans of Casanova are very upset. So this is an ongoing vendetta, trying to wipe out a guy who besmirched a guy who was your rival. There was an earlier incident where Assistant Chief Casanova had berated an officer, called him an effing mope, and all this stuff outside a substation, then called the officer into his office and wouldn't let him at first have union representation. And in that case, Chief Campbell gave him a 1-day suspension, and that led to protests on the street of partisans of Casanova, because he was very popular from his work in the Latino community and also with immigrant rights activists. And they said, because at that time, Campbell was only interim chief. He's now the permanent chief. And there was that competition. They said, this is about the competition. The other side said that was not overreacting to say for one day, chill out and make sure you respect people on the force and union rights. So what do you think, John? Like, when you heard about this, what'd you make of the whole thing?
Well, I think that Chief Campbell did the right thing. The assistant chief can't undermine the chief of police. That just can't happen. If you allow that to happen, then the chain of command will degrade all the way down to the bottom, and it sends a mixed message to the officers in patrol. I think that if you need, in this instance, and in every instance, judge it, you know, singularly, right? And this, forget about they were rivals and forget about the backstory for a minute. You have officers who are deficient in an area, search and seizure. The chief addressed that. And that's a great way to address it. You know, not all discipline not all punishment has to be punitive. It doesn't have to be negative. A lot of it is a recalibration into what we do. So he sent them for training.
So you like that discipline?
That's a great idea, of course. Okay. Absolutely. It's absolutely something that should be done. And to alter that, I have to be honest with you. I was assistant chief. I worked under chiefs. Even as a lieutenant, you don't do that to your captain, sergeant. You don't do that to your lieutenant.
Do you think it could have been an innocent mistake given the politics of the situation that he should just left alone? Or do you think that this was a deliberate way to undermine?
Oh, that, you know, I'm not really sure about that. I could tell you that the way it sounds, it may have been just a difference in opinion and maybe an overstep on the assistant chief's part. I mean, but he, you know, he's been an assistant chief long enough to know he can't do that. I don't think he would have done that if it were Chief Esserman, to be quite honest with you.
And what about Chief Campbell? So when he knows the history of this, he knows how it's going to play.
Right.
And it's a political environment right now where there's a mayor race going on, where there's, so this can be brought up there. Yeah. Do you think there was any reason for him to say, step back and just let it go? Or does that make it impossible for him to establish himself as the chief who's in charge of this department?
No, he absolutely cannot step back and let it go. Absolutely not. What would probably occur if there wasn't the backdrop that we've seen with the rivalry for chief was that as the chief, you would do a preliminary investigation yourself, and you were trying to figure out whether you could substantiate any of these things. And if you did, you would act on that without.
And what
bringing
would that mean, for instance? Would that include? I mean, there were memos submitted by the people at the
right.
At the, I think a sergeant lieutenant, if I'm not mistaken, right. At the training academy.
Yep.
Would that be what constitutes a preliminary investigation, or is there more?
Sure. If I were the chief and I got those, I would bring those officers in and I would interview them myself. I would conduct an investigation myself at the chief's level. You should be able to do that. You could do that.
Is there a need for an IA?
There's a need for an IA in this regard. So what we can do in two, you know, we do two types of internal affairs investigations. We do one that is the catalyst for the first, the complaint is the public. And then there's the second one called an I case, which is the chief decides to open this up. Now, sometimes, an assistant chief who is the subject of the investigation, a lot of times the chief himself will do that. But I think that what Anthony Campbell might be thinking is, listen, I don't want to do this, because if I do this, people are going to really look at it as if this is a one-sided and it's, it's a jaded thing here. So let me send it off to internal affairs and give it as much autonomy as I can. Get it away from me as much as I can.
On the other hand, in the earlier incident, he did not go to internal affairs because he said, look, I went and talked to Lou Casanova, and he admitted he did that. He said he didn't let the union come in at first, and he's sorry.
Sure.
And he disagreed about what he meant by effing mope. But that he felt, Andy, that it wasn't a huge deal, but there wasn't something that needed an IA because the guy said, look, I did that, and that it was one day. But the partisans who were demonstrating for Casanova said that should have been a neutral IA. So maybe he had that in mind this time.
I'm sure what Chief Campbell said, you know, we've been down this road before, and look at the way it played out last time. This time I'm going to send it off to internal affairs and let them make the determination. And take it from there. I think it's a good idea. I think he did everything he should do, to be quite honest with you.
Harry Jost, any thoughts?
Well, obviously, you know, black and white are trying to squeeze out brown, right?
Well, where's the white come in? Oh, Vileka.
Vileka. I had to say it, but no. I actually sure agree with John. That's a pecking order. He knows better than that, or he should know better than that.
Right.
No controversy here.
Well, you should know that you're listening to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Now, John, you were in that position. You wanted to be the chief of police in New Haven.
Right.
And instead, Dean Esserman was hired in 2011.
That's right.
What did it feel like in that office when a new person comes in and knows that somebody else there wanted his job? And was it friendly? Was it we're all go for one team? Were there little incidents that were sparking up like this? What happened?
Between myself and Dean Esserman?
And the whole feeling in the suite. And well, the other people who saw a new person come in didn't want to be...
Right.
So I'd like to have been the chief.
Okay, so I guess...
Adjer wanted to be the
sure,
chief.
Yeah. I think that was different because Dean Esserman is very different than Anthony Campbell. But I can tell you that it wasn't a good feeling. There were a lot of things where... this was an established chief that was coming in. We knew how he thought, his philosophies, and a lot of what I believed in didn't quite line up with his, and I knew it was going to be a difficult road to go down. And it was. And the first, we only worked together by, I think, 3 days, 4 days. And there were 3 or 4 days filled with, controversy between the two of us,
And that, there were chiefs who came before him. There was Frank Lamone. There was James Lewis.
Right.
In each case, that chief brought in all of his own assistant chiefs.
Right.
And Dean Esserman asked his assistant chiefs to retire. I think was Pat Redding one of them too?
Pat one, yeah.
So they all retired, and including you.
Right.
And he said, I really want to do my own team my own way.
Yep.
And I remember, if I'm not mistaken, when Cisco Ortiz became chief, he also, Brian Norwood, had wanted that job, and they're binding some tension
right
there, and then Brian Norwood left. I mean, obviously, there's an argument that you want the experience there. The people who are assistant chiefs, you want them to stay because they know the way around. If they work well with that new boss, you want them doing that.
Right.
But in any kind of workplace, it also seems often if people have different ideas. I've been told that Casanova and Campbell claim they have very different approaches to policing. I'm not sure what the substance of that is. But in those cases, you often see the person, I guess what you decide to do is step aside, take, and the retirements. I say to someone, if you retire assistant chief, you get what, like $100,000 a year?
Who, me?
Anyone.
No. It depends on how your pension lays out.
But it's pretty high.
It's decent. Some are higher than others. Some officers, their pension is higher.
But I
remember
when, for instance, Ariel Melendez got something like 110.
Well, that was a little different story. They took
Stephanie
that clause
Redding
out.
Got 110.
120 some odd. But that was a clause.
But even
that was
if
in the
I were to get, I'm
now.
Sure no one gets under 80.
Right.
If someone told me, and I'm into my middle age, 45, 50,
yep.
I'm older now, 57. Someone said, you don't like your new boss. You're fighting every day coming into work. You could retire and have for the rest of your life $80,000 or more a year and health insurance guaranteed until you
right.
die
yep.
and go do something else. And if you want to be chief one day, a new mayor can come in, because a lot of people support Lou Casanova,
yep.
and make you the chief anyway, the way Nick Pastore came back.
Right.
I don't know if it would take me more than 7 seconds to decide to put in my retirement papers.
Yeah, that's a logical way to look at that situation, but I could tell you there's more that goes into that thought process. A lot of times where, I could tell you from my own personal, I won't even speculate as to what like a guy like Lou Casanova is thinking. I could tell you that there were things that I wanted to see survive, which meant more to me than the money, which I knew that if I were to leave.
Casanova feels very, I know he feels very committed to the work he's put in over the
right.
years, and feels like I fought for this department to be a good department, to run a certain way.
Right.
I want to make sure that still happens. He sees people he feels will undermine that. He wants to fight the good fight. I wonder sometimes whether it's hard to step back and realize that you're not going to win that fight. You're just going to destroy yourself.
That's true. And after the jobs we have here, the police department, the community here in New Haven becomes more of a family than it is just a workplace. So it's hard to step away from that. Think about stepping away
then
from your
out,
family.
Your kind of life is away.
Right. Everything is different.
You have this intense life where every day so much goes on, and you're serving the public, and you feel like you're united right as a team to make the
right.
New Haven a better place.
Yeah.
Make your life meaningful.
And, you have it.
It's hard to go mow lawns after that.
Right. It's hard. It's just difficult to step away from. I understand that. But there's also, and like what I posted was simply, sometimes the stuff at the upper end of the police department is too much for the patrol officer. So in other words, the patrol officers don't want to go.
When mommy and daddy are fighting, it's hard for the kids.
Well, right, yeah. So you don't want to have a new patrol officer, which we have a lot of. Show up at a family function or go to the gym or wherever it is and say, things are a mess in New Haven. What's going on with the chief and the assistant chief? That hurts them. you know, and that hurts their ability to do their job, and it lowers morale.
Do you think this is affecting the department now?
I absolutely believe it is. Of course it is.
How does that affect it on the ground? Does it affect their ability to do their job?
It looks to the out to the public as if that things at the department are unsettled, right? So when the officers are going to calls, in the back of their mind, they're wondering whether the people that they're trying to serve have any kind of confidence or faith in what they could do because the apartment appears to be in disarray. But it's in all actuality, it's not, right? It's a personal thing between a couple people. But that can't trickle down and transcend everything, you know? And I think that's what you really have to look at. And sometimes as the chief or the assistant chief, the best leadership quality you can have is the ability to see the forest through the trees and to step away from that, to keep going.
What was it like for you psychologically to suddenly wake up after you retired and your job in the morning was to make yourself a cup of coffee?
Oh, it was terrible.
Take your kid out
terrible.
For
Very
know,
difficult.
A run or something.
Very difficult.
And what is the hard part of that? Is it being away from the action, being away from
the
people?
No, because it's not really the action. You know, you only see that. It's the people. It's the people in the department. And it's, you know, the people in the community that you know, you actually, it sounds corny, but you do make people's lives better by being out there. And it's good to see a return on what you're doing, especially in the detective division when you're dealing with people that are going through such trauma like a homicide. It's good to be there to lend a hand to help, to know you're helping people instead of just sitting home doing nothing. You know what I mean?
All right, but what you are doing is you're listening to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Our guests today are WNHH resident policing expert, John Vileka.
Policing expert.
That's right.
Thanks, Aaron.
And Donald
Trump.
I
like that title.
Expert, Harry
Droz.
Well, there was a big news in the police department. This is a huge one this week. The city settled a lawsuit from a man who spent 18 years in prison and trumped up charges. His name was Scott Lewis. He was a drug dealer.
Right.
And in 1990, he was arrested along with another guy, Stephen Morant, for allegedly shooting to death a former alderman who had become a drug dealer himself, Ricardo Turner, and his lover, Lamont Fields, 4 a.m. in a bed in the hill. Gruesome murder. The detective named Vincent Rauchy made that case. After this guy got convicted, he said he didn't do it. The FBI wrote a report, did an investigation that we actually published at the time in a publication called the New Haven Advocate, that said that Rauchy was deeply involved in the cocaine trade in New Haven to the extent of even doing errands for the mafia boss who ran it from the New England organization, and that he had fabricated, they found many ways in which the evidence wasn't real against this guy, Scott Lewis, and that it was fabricated, that Rauchy had a main witness who was compromised, lie to make up a story and fed him what to say. And despite that report and the FBI, because I remember talking to the agents, they were convinced that Scott Lewis was innocent. I remember going up to visit Scott Lewis in jail, and his one of the corrections officers said, everybody says they're innocent. But it's weird. This guy's clearly telling the truth.
Right. Well.
Despite that, the state wouldn't release him. The prosecutor said, you got to prove it. And he had his own lawyer, and then he wasn't getting along with that lawyer. And the state, up to the state Supreme Court, kept him in jail. And then these law students helped him out. Took 18 years where federal judges said, we can't believe you kept this guy in jail. They actually issued a panel of federal judges issued a decision slamming the state judges, saying, how could you do such a thing? And he got out in 2014, resumed his life, sued the city. The city this week, at the beginning, they fought the lawsuit. And the judge, Stephen Underhill, federal judge, sits in Bridgeport, a good judge. He said, no, I'm not dismissing this case. You guys let this detective clearly, and the detective's no longer on the force. He retired, but he had done a bunch of other things too, and there was a long trail. I read his personnel file, long trail of drug use, involvement, and compromised cases. This case going forward. So the city decided, Mayor Tony Harper this week saying, her lawyers told her they often give $1 million a year for you in jail, so that would have been $18
million. Right.
Said, we're cutting her losses. $9.5 million the city's going to pay. This is at a time when, even though we're in better fiscal condition than other cities in Connecticut, because of the state budget crisis, this is a tough time. We might be looking at $60 million in cash we thought we had that we don't come September if there's no budget. We're now paying $9.5. That's a big settlement. What did you guys think of this?
Well, for me, I think they should have paid the 18. You know, you put some guy in jail, he missed a good portion of his life. So he deserves whatever, you know.
What did you think of the settlement, John?
Well, let me first say that a lot of the times when we talk about settlements for lawsuits, listen, you can't stop anybody from bringing a lawsuit. This guy has obviously got a lot of merit to his lawsuit, right? But when you get to talk about settlements, it becomes strictly a business decision. So there's not a lot of, you know, like you said, how, you know, they should pay the 18 because it's, you know, there's feeling and emotion behind that. But a lot of times when the lawyers get together, most times, all the time, it becomes a business decision, right? So $18 million the mayor puts on it. It could have been more. Let's not forget. It could have been more. She's saying 18 because that's what they believe. But if it was as egregious and the judges, you don't know. They could have got more than that, you know? So I think that a lot goes into determining that $9.5 million was probably the best way out for the city. And it's a huge number. I'm not telling you that it's not. But in the long run, I would bet anything that it's probably worked out. It's the best business decision for the city, sure.
Question is, how do we make sure that we don't have more lawsuits like this? Are we keeping enough of supervision over cops? Because New Haven Police Department, like any organization in the world, has a lot of great people, and some people don't do the job well.
Right.
When they don't do the job well, are they disciplined? Is a message sent to other cops that that's not going to be okay? Because they know, obviously, my big hang-up is the thing with the cameras. Years we've been following how they haven't followed. And I think there's a big lawsuit in that. I mean, we could have sued the Independent when they arrested us and took the camera after a consent decree they signed. They weren't going to do that anymore. Obviously, we're not, because we're not into suing people. But we've documented in our site over and over again, they continue to violate this U.S. Constitution, their own, the state law, and their own general orders about how to handle people with cameras. And they take them away when they shouldn't. They arrest people on these trumped up charges. Is that a lawsuit waiting for happen? Why haven't they addressed this?
Well, so we take two lawsuits you can't avoid, right? So if the real question, how do we stop or prevent police misconduct and corruption?
That's going to cost us a lot of money.
Right. So, you know, back before I started narcotics again, I took 6 months, and this was all Jim Lewis wanted me to study. How do we prevent misconduct? How do we
corruption?
Oh,
that's right, because you were there. The next big scandal was about 10 years ago, right, when the FBI arrested detectives in the Detective Bureau, right, of Narcotics, because they said they were fabricating evidence, right, I guess.
And then prior to that, don't forget, we had
cleaning up that unit and having it have integrity.
And don't forget, 5 years before that, we had a state grand jury into the same thing. We had the captain of the detective division, the Cusick job, right? So, you know, we had some people get arrested.
What experience, John Vileka, about how do you ensure that this doesn't go on?
So, like I said, we went to multiple training sessions on that and went to different police departments who had problems with that.
And what did you learn? We learned a few things.
That the redundant underlying problems were a lack of articulate policy, lack of updated articulate policies, which we're guilty of, negligent training, and poor supervision. And that was really, when we saw everywhere you looked for police corruption or misconduct, you can backtrack it to those three things.
What about the inability to discipline people when they do wrong?
Well,
to speak to the officers when a policy is violated. Like, what's up with the cameras?
So we can scroll this back. I answer one more thing was training, and training and hiring were deficient as well. So you line that up. So you're right. So you could say you could have great policies, right? But if you're not enforcing them, you're not making people adhere to the policies are worthless.
It's amazing to me how far they've gone in not having people understand that. I sat in training sessions 10 years ago, and they say we're now doing it because the new state law passed that individual officers are liable if they take your camera.
Right.
I saw this consent decree when they got sued and lost, and that they said then they were going to train everybody. Why is this so hard?
So what you'll see is, we're talking about search and seizure, we talk about the cameras, we talk about things like that. These are things that are, even though they look at, like they're one-dimensional, hard and fast to the public, there are incidents where we can take a camera, right? So sometimes the officer will get tripped up.
But then they use that as an excuse to always.
And sometimes.
So I'll give you an example. Sometimes like they can use it as an excuse. In the case of Renee Dominguez, when she took our reporter's camera, the Internal Affairs report stated, this violates our policy. But since she could have made up another reason, which wasn't a true reason, about why she took the camera, we're not going to discipline her. So she got promoted. There was never a single word given to the department that rallied around her that she did anything wrong. How does this not set you up for another case, another lawsuit in the future?
So they're saying that the act itself was not against policy.
They said it was, but if she had given a different reason, it would have been. Right.
So the act itself was not against policy, but her intention was.
Well, there are theoretically times if it were crucial to the investigation of the crime,
right,
which it was not.
Yeah.
So it was not okay. The act was not okay. The act would have been okay if she had done it for a different reason under different circumstances. Is that enough to say we're not going to discipline, we're not going to say anything was wrong, we're not going to make sure people don't do that again?
Well, you know, I don't, like I said, I don't like to undermine what the you know, I'm not the chief there, and what they've decided. Maybe it's probably not something I would have done.
You're saying she shouldn't have been, you know, promoted because she made a mistake?
Not because she made a mistake. She made a series of mistakes that was in line with behavior she had conducted for years. My biggest argument here is that if you've had a problem with this policy that keeps getting broken, if a person in authority who oversees other cops breaks it again, you don't say we're not going to discipline her because if she had made up a reason that wasn't her reason, it would have been okay.
Well,
that doesn't send a signal like we're going to take this seriously.
Well, they're saying because she didn't lie, it was okay.
That's what they... No. They're saying that because if she had lied, it would have been okay. We're not going to discipline her.
Right. So because she didn't lie, we're not going to discipline her. Yeah. But,
That does not sound to me
like
we're sending
them. They should actually apologize.
They sent a consent decree.
But it's boring, going to let it go.
No, but they signed a consent decree months earlier where they said we're going to extra train our cops because we keep breaking this policy.
So, right, did that training take place? Did they claim
it was read at the lineup, but now, right. Now a supervisory officer breaks it and they say there won't be any consequences. We're not even going to publicly say we wish she hadn't done it.
So
is that a way to get this policy?
I'll scroll back and I'll tell you that I don't believe you should hold up somebody's promotion for that. I think that when you're promoting somebody, you should view that officer holistically, look at everything they do. Mistakes are going to happen. Like I talked to you before about recalibration and retraining. What did we do? So let's say Renee didn't get disciplined, but she our own internal affairs said maybe there was something that she could have done better.
No, but then they concluded she did fine because she could have lied and made up another reason.
Well, it's okay. So I'm not going to get on board with that. You know,
but
what about
separate from Renee?
Right.
What about this? And I agree. Separate from Renee, she has a lot of people think she's a great cop. What about the message to your department? You've signed a consent decree. You've lost these cases. An assistant chief had to resign because he violated that policy. Another top-ranking cop had to resign because he violated that policy and he got disciplined. But now after you signed a consent decree, because it's still going on, if you don't make a single statement that we think this shouldn't have happened, if you don't make a single statement that we think it's wrong to do this, how are you sending any message to your department that you think it should be followed?
Well, I think back when the first incident happened, and this was when Frank Lamone was there and Ariel, you know, took the camera, we did come out and say this was wrong. This was not something that we should have done.
And then it kept happening. And then you had to sign a consent decree because you lost two cases. So now Renee Dominguez does it, and you sweep it under the rug. You don't make a single sentence that says we think we shouldn't have done that.
Okay, well, I don't want to jump on board with sweeping things under the rug, but what I say is maybe... Maybe it could have been handled in the public eye differently. It certainly could have been worded better, I believe.
No, to this day, there's not been a single word spoken by anyone at the police department.
Right.
Even after the judge threw out the case and said it was completely meritless.
Yeah.
There's not been a single word. And they arrested a reporter.
Right.
Doing his job. There's not been a single word from any police officer or any elected official saying maybe this wasn't the right way to do it.
I think they should just come out and say, my bad.
what do you lose better. There?
Now, as for Renee...
I don't think you lose anything, to be honest with you.
As for Renee, I think she was doing her job. She may have made a mistake, Paul. Now, if by all accounts she's a good cop...
Not by all accounts. There are a lot of complaints about her abusing authority, military-style cop. Didn't even know the people in that neighborhood. Now they've sent her to New Orleans.
What does military style mean?
Which is that we are...
Authoritative?
Where you don't get to know the people in your neighborhood, you threaten them with arrest as the first resort. Like I was talking to one guy in the neighborhood who's active and stuff. He was walking to the Yale Tennis Center. She yelled at him, you're not supposed to walk on the side of the street, and followed him after and berated him and threatened to arrest him if he didn't hurry up. This 55-year-old dad with his kid.
And that's what he said.
Yeah. But I've seen her act like that. She's just like, I was there at the scene. She just
has a temper problem. She came forth with the truth. And I think you have to give her credit for that.
Okay.
You know, and that's what they're saying. Hey, look, she made a mistake. She came forth with the truth. We're not going to discipline her. No biggie here.
But they're not going to say anything like
this. I know it's big for you.
But they don't think after all these years of people having to resign and losing lawsuits and having a state law written because of what the New England police did wrong, you don't think they should have said we should follow this rule now?
I think that there, and you know me, we've talked about this many times. I think that there's something to be said for the head of the agency who comes out and says, listen, we made a mistake. We're going to be doing all we can do to try and fix the mistake, and here's what we're going to do for that. I think people are forgiving if you do that, right?
Right, immediately.
And I think that in New Haven, and at least from my personal opinion, we have gotten to a point where we are in fear of disciplining our officers. I think that we're
and
worried
ever
about
saying publicly,
grievances. We're worried
Esserman
about
never did this. They never say we were wrong. It's impossible not to make a mistake.
Right, right.
When you're doing that much work every day in tense situations. I have never heard Anthony Campbell or Lou Casanova public or Tony Reyes, the assistant chiefs, publicly say about anything. And we brought so many cases to them. Esserman either. He used to yell at me when I tried to ask him, was I wrong? I've never heard them say,
that's a personality
we
flaw,
made a mistake. We'll do better next time. We're sorry. I've never heard this once.
I think that since we've been talking now, we've been doing this for over a year, right? I think I've been telling you this about how, and I think that the public in the very near future is going to demand that the head of the agency comes out and is just straight and on the level. Look, if we made a mistake,
but what it is that your cops who are gangbangers think that's making you a pussy and that they're not going to respect you. And that's what they're scared of. They're scared that the police will not support them in the rank and file. The guys who like to bust heads will not be your friend.
I think you want cops that just walk around with a smile.
No, no.
And I prefer an authoritative cop. I prefer it.
But your authority comes from having doing your job fairly and not busting people's heads or arresting them at the first resort.
See,
we are told, Harry, that the policy of the police department...
That's all relative to what's happening, right?
We are told the policy of New Haven Police Department is arrest is the last resort. She is definitely of the school that arrest is the first resort. And they've never once questioned that publicly. But you like him as arresting right away, just to go around arresting people. Stop your car.
It's not that I like... First off, you see, me and Paul, we disagree here because I know, you know, I'm part of the team and our reporter got arrested. But at the same time, I felt if there was a, you know, the possibility of a bomb, he shouldn't have been in the area.
All right. But okay, that's separate. Okay. On that case, by the IA report, he was pointed by a cop to go there. They asked him to get out. And in 5 seconds, he leaves. The whole argument was for those 5 seconds. Did he hear them or not and move quickly enough? That's an understandable. Of course they were upset. Of course it had been a bomb big deal. Of course it was huge. The question is, why is that an arrest? And the judge said there was no basis for an arrest. The officer who pointed him to the scene had a memory loss when IA asked him about it. Whenever someone who's not a cop has a memory loss, the cops crack up and then double the charges. Okay? So there was no basis.
But the guy with the memory loss, you're going to blame the person who... didn't know that the memory loss guy sent them in.
So no, I don't blame them for being upset. My whole issue was the arrest. Renee Dominguez was the officer in charge, and she wanted to punish him because she was so mad. That's why she took the camera.
Right,
that's why she did the charges.
But because of the situation.
Criminal charges.
Everybody's life was at stake at that moment because they didn't know what that package was.
And that's why we have supervisors who are trained, that in those situations...
Yeah, but they're not robots, Paul.
Okay, so if they make a mistake, say, sorry, you made a mistake. You don't drag it 7 months
sorry
through the court. But you don't... No, you dropped the charges,
John, you
want to
apologize?
No, not apologize. 7 months. They went through the court on this.
I get it.
I agree with the fact that sometimes as police officers, we make mistakes, and I surely believe that it's well worth the time just to apologize about it and say, look, I made a mistake. Here's what I'm going to do to rectify it. And here's what I'm going to do in the future to make sure it doesn't happen again. I will tell you, I know Renee. Renee's a good cop. I know, you know, we do have a contingency of officers who are still authority. But that's, listen, if we have officers in the New Haven Police Department and everybody adheres to different philosophies, that's not a Renee Dominguez problem. That's a chief problem.
Agreed.
That means that what's going throughout that police department, the philosophy is not being adhered to.
So do you think she's the right person to go to New Hallville where we... shootings and murders just went down for a whole year with a different approach.
Here's what I can tell you about Renee. I think that if Renee did something wrong and you brought her in and say, listen, Renee, we want you to do this way and here's why. She's receptive to that.
She wasn't in this case.
Did anybody do that?
To this
did
day.
Anybody do that though? Did anybody of rank do that for her and bring her in and sit her down and say, listen.
That's a good point.
You know, here's what I do
That's
want
true.
You to do.
That's true. The issue here
is
the brass. It's not her.
I could tell you, you know, not because Tony Reyes and I worked together, but Tony Reyes, you know what he did great for me? You know, whether it was in the patrol division
he's
or
the
in,
assistant chief now. Yeah.
In the detective division, Tony was not afraid to go put gear on, to go get in a patrol car, and go bring that message to officers if he needed to in the field. That was what he did. That's why he has the reputation he has. I think that we need to see more of that. Get out there. Bring the. If your message from the third floor is not getting to the second floor, go to the second floor and bring it, and tell these guys and tell the cops what you want them to do. Listen, they'll do it. I'm telling you, they will do it. But you need to tell them.
Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we were talking about this $9.5 million settlement. I'm sorry I got us off the track on that case. Because what was more important was, like, Tony Harp and Chief Campbell told me some of the things they're doing to try to prevent cases like this in the future. And you're right, John. You'll always get lawsuits, but you want to try to avoid having the actual misconduct happen.
Right.
One thing they're doing is they brought a psychological consultant in to help the people who vet applicants for the force to try to recognize earlier on if they're going to be rogue cops. Is that realistic?
No, I don't agree with that at all. To be honest with you, I think that there certainly we can increase our screening before we hire, but I don't believe that we hire rogue cops. I think that cops become that way over a certain amount of years on the job, in the field. Don't forget, you know, the officers see the dark side of life every single day. And if there is not constant supervision, right? And if there's not a supervisor paying attention, I can tell you, working in narcotics offsite with various degrees of undercover officers who checked in with me maybe once a week, you have to be on top of that because you can lose a cop quick.
So what they said about the constant supervision,
right,
is that they now have a policy with every time you use any force, three different people, you have to write a report and three people review it, three supervisors. And that includes if you pull your gun but don't use it.
Right.
Will that help? Is that going to stop cats the next Vinny Rauci who's a crack addict and running around and working with the mob and setting
Absolutely
up people
not.
For murder?
Absolutely not. No.
You don't think this three-step process works? So what kind of supervision do you mean?
I think that there's nothing can take the place of physically being out there with your police officers. I sincerely believe that, whether that's with your detectives, whether it's with your officers in the street. Listen, you're going to get a report. We've all been there. Somebody signs off on it as a good use of force. Guess what? The next two are signing off on it the same way. Come on, let's not BS anybody here. But you know what? If there's
like this guy's getting sued, this Conklin guy, this detective who got promoted, his supervisor was also being sued for the same offense. He's the guy who signed off on it.
It's very difficult, and a lot of supervisors will tell you it's very difficult to get the true gist, so to speak, of the incident from a piece of paper. Right, so they're going to read a report, right? And it may, the report's written, it may look like a really by the book use of force. However, if you were out on the scene, it may not have looked like that report actually watching it, right? So you know now what's going to happen in these days. We're going to get that report. We're going to have three people sign off on it because the report is going to read like it's by the book. And then somebody's going to pop up with a video, right?
Mm.
And the report's not going to match the video, right? That's the value
Where
of having.
Where have we seen this movie before?
Right. So that's the
so
value
Chief
of having
Campbell
somebody
agreed
in the field.
With you about supervision, he said that's why it was important that we hired more cops, promoted more cops.
Yeah.
And in the past, we had only two patrol officers for the whole city on B squad overnight. You know, late into the evening, early morning, usually up to midnight or one. Right.
Right.
We only had two for the whole city, and we had dozens of cops, and now we'll have up to four.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that'll help make a difference.
I think so, yeah.
And we're talking about that on Dateline New Haven, WNHH Radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. So did you see, Harry and John, that another homeless encampment has sprung up? So over the winter, we had one spring up in Cedar Hill near the I-91 exit there, not far from Wilbur Cross. It's always on state land and woods. Cedar Hill neighbors are upset because it's near a neighborhood and they felt like they were bringing a lot of trash. It could be a big fire. I went there and I saw, they'd have these tarps for a tent, and then right under it, they'd have a flame, which, it'd be kind of scary. A lot of people getting very drunk or stoned out of methanol. But then you talk to the people who are there and say, we really don't want to be shelters for whatever reasons. We don't like the rules, or here's my wife and I are here in this tent, one told me, and we can't be there to get a homeless shelter. So the city didn't bulldoze that first shelter, but said, this is a public safety hazard. They spent a week with social service people from homeless shelters, health department. And they met with every single person, said, how can we help you? How can we get you services you need? But you do need to leave in a week. And finally, they had to leave in a week. It got cleaned up. Now it's popped up again by Ralph Walker Rink there by their Mill River under I-91 off State Street. And, needles all over the place, tons of bottles. But it's summer now. And they also are asking those people to leave. And they've gradually been clearing them out. The root of it, according to Tony Harp, she thinks she said most people coming, it used to be just from Waterbury. Now as far as Willimantic.
Right.
Come to New Haven for methadone treatment, heroin addicts, other opioid addicts. And it's because, she said, we have more services here and they're considered better for the addicts because, you don't have to have a clean urine in some places to get your methadone, and that the state government has passed rules actually that limit suburban communities' ability to even open these centers, even if they were open to doing it.
Right.
What do you think is the way for police to, and the government to handle this? Either
is that a good thing for the city that everybody's coming in and there's no rules, they could get their methadone regardless of
obviously everyone's upset about this. The police I speak to are upset about it. The neighbor groups are upset about it. The mayor's upset about it. They say, there are a lot of zombies. You'd be looking like zombies the green. And then
understand this. Everybody in the country now is cracking down on opioids, right? So wherever opioids, whether it was dealing or use, police departments are now cracking down. So why do you have people from Willimantic? Probably because Willimantic PD is cracking down on that, pushing them down into the city areas. And listen, I understand that we do have methadone clinics here where you could go in with a dirty urine, you could still get your medication. But don't forget that we have a very strong low-level drug market that still exists here on the green. If you want to walk across the green right now, that kind of an open-air, low-level drug market where you can buy any kind of pill you want, any kind of, this is not where they're not moving weight, so to speak, on the green. That doesn't exist in a lot of other towns. So people will take the bus in, they'll jump off the bus, they'll walk across the green, then they'll go to the homeless shelter. The encampment.
Yeah.
And these homeless shelters, they split up families just like Trump's immigration law. Because
that's quite the analogy, Harry.
It is, because they don't, a lot of times they break up the family. You can't have your family.
The truth is you're not capable of taking care of kids if you're strung out on drugs, right? And living on the street.
We used to just monitor them.
We do have homeless family facilities, Christian Community Action. When you're talking about kids, we have Christian Community Action.
Those shelters get filled up very quickly, and then there's people on waiting lists trying to get those, and they end up, in tent cities.
Yeah, and it's funny, when we interviewed people at both encampments, we didn't see anyone who was trying to get into a homeless shelter. And in New Haven, we moved towards supportive housing, which is a really good thing, like Liberty Community Services, where they have drug treatment. You can be on drugs, you're there, and you're getting your help. What I'm wondering is, what do you do about encampment? If someone wants to sleep in the woods and not follow rules, should we let them?
We used to, this is not the first time these popped up, but they weren't as big as they are now. A lot of times in that very spot, we would monitor something and we would monitor the activity going there. If they're building fires, absolutely, we can't have that. The fire's going to go out, we have to remove them. When it gets to the point, though, where it's no longer a homeless encampment for people to sleep, it becomes a drug den, or a place where you can go in and commit, whatever quality of life violation you want in there without any repercussion, that is going to bleed into the neighborhoods, right? And that is going to affect our kids, and it's going to affect our
community. Oh, yeah, the guys are right outside, doing drugs.
So we have to, as the police, it may seem inhumane because we're locking up people there, but we have to do something.
Those officers. They're always out there saying, I've seen how much they care about the people and how much the people trust the officers who are on drugs. I've seen the interactions. The officers say, look, we have to enforce some rules. I want to help you.
Right.
That's been a real change in our department over the years. It's been a good change.
And then we have the city cutting on the needle programs and all that.
The city didn't cut the needle program. They transferred it to Yale and they lost the state funding.
What the city used to do.
Oh, really? What don't they do?
The city workers used to actually go out and find these people.
Right. We had a van. I thought Yale was also taking over the van.
No, they're not doing it, and they had a connection.
They said they are.
They would but the guy who used to do it, and I actually know them, and they used to get them clothes, they used to get them food. It wasn't just the needle program. They used to do a lot more. They used to service them a lot more.
It was a great program. Now the state has cut the money for every city. We had the last one.
Everything.
Social services is surely playing a role. And I agree with that. And like I said, Paul, when I ran narcotics, I agree with that end of it. But at the same time, let's not get so consumed with social services where we just forget about the enforcement aspect of it, because there is an important enforcement aspect of battling this at the lowest level.
Yeah, there is. I remember you talked also, John, when this last happened, you were concerned about someone actually getting killed at one of these places.
We've kind
of been lucky that no one's died yet at one of these places.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. I really feel for the cops who are on the front lines of issues we haven't resolved in our nation, whether it's drugs or immigration.
Yeah, sure. What do you do as the cop and you walk into the encampment and you're charged with taking responsibility and taking action there? That's a tough call.
So I think you have to treat them like immigrants and just walk away and
just walk away.
Well, you know, he's being sarcastic.
I know, I see. He's leading in.
And for the second time, as of yesterday, a second immigrant has come to New Haven. In both cases, first from Norwalk, first from Meriden. An undocumented immigrant who's been here for decades, hardworking, paid taxes, raising kids, and every year gets a stay.
Let me just interrupt right there. Paying taxes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's an illegal immigrant. How is he paying taxes?
They get tax identification numbers. It's been happening on a wide scale, Harry.
Because a lot of people I know, they say they claim the same thing, and they're doing it under an alias.
Yeah.
They stole somebody's Social Security number or something. That's an additional law that they're breaking.
Okay.
And, you know, so it's incredible.
People, let's just tell people what happened. Here's a guy, just like Nuri Chanderia, a few weeks ago.
He's been here 7 years, right?
He's been here 20 years. He was fleeing violence in Ecuador.
I thought I read 7 years.
No, he came in 1997. And then as of 2002, he was paying taxes. He's worked as a contractor all over the state. He's raising kids. Hasn't gotten any trouble with the law. And every year he gets a stay of deportation under the old policy in our country. He was a productive member of society. Now, even though President Trump said his new policy is to get rid of the violent criminals, and that's what we want out of our country, we don't want to break up families. Second time in a week, we have someone who has kids, who's been here a long time, that the policy has changed, that we're no longer going to give a stay of deportation, you have to leave. So it's the day he was supposed to leave, again, this happened, he came to New Haven, where churches have agreed to be sanctuaries, because the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE agents, have said that we will not go on church grounds. And the community supports them, and so he's staying in the church. This happened a couple weeks ago in Fairhaven. A woman came, Nuri, and then she got permission to stay for now after she was in there a few weeks. Otherwise, she'd been back to Guatemala. Any thoughts on this, guys?
I think we're going to find a liberal judge who's going to give him a stay. It doesn't really matter. Let's just forget about our borders. Let's open them up. Let's let everybody who sees.
But Harry, didn't you used to say that you agree that the issue should be the violent criminals? We have 11 million people.
I do agree,
people.
Paul. But you see,
so then how do you feel about these non-violent, law-abiding people?
You're conflating. When they say focus, that means they're actually going after them. Now, these people who have gotten stays before, the policy changed, so they just have to live by that change in the policy. Nobody's focusing on them.
But why change that policy? They're not violent. We have 11 million people.
Because he's not Obama. Is that simple?
You're not talking about the merits of the point. The point is our country is going to be hurt by this. We're going to spend a lot of money to deport them. If you look at what any economist is writing, Harry, that even
Krugman, who hasn't been writing in 40 years.
I was looking at Eduardo Porter this morning, who had an article about how all the studies are showing, including conservative think tanks, that poor people are going to have fewer jobs in this country if you kicked out the unskilled labor, because they create a market, like restaurants that have all these people.
Wait a minute, that makes no sense,
Paul. It makes no sense to you, but that's what the data has shown.
No,
I'll show you the article.
That's absolutely
they're saying, it sounds
wrong.
Like it makes no sense, but what happened, a lot of these places.
So you have immigrants come in and take jobs, and if they leave, those jobs are going to leave with them? That makes
Can I at least tell you the argument he made? There were a lot of places like restaurants and other service
businesses.
I would
love to have that guy come in and I'll debate him, because that's wrong.
Watch,
that's not even basic economics.
Do you even want to know any facts? I don't know. The facts were the studies they showed that in places where there were unfilled jobs in service industries like dishwashers, home care, the businesses didn't operate because they couldn't fill those jobs, and that in other countries where they had the more restrictions and they did fill those jobs, the costs were much higher. The unskilled labor came in and actually created people in the front who could speak English and deal with the public, and that there are a lot of jobs that are just going unfilled in a lot of places, and that it creates more economic activity, and that in fact that not only high skill and that their kids become the high skilled workers they also say they want to have in, and that stopping immigration has never ever been shown to create jobs. It just it lowers economic activity.
I disagree that.
I know, because you don't want to look at how economists study it from
no
all
offense
sides.
To the guy, but
left
that's,
and right
that's,
center have all come to that
that's
conclusion.
That's ass backwards economy.
Okay.
Economics.
John, any thoughts on you about
just
the
no
latest
way.
I'll be honest with you. On the heels of talking about the opioid crisis, I can't lend any credibility to fishing this guy out and sending him back to Ecuador. I think we have bigger things to worry about, to be quite honest with you. This guy is, we're talking about people in an encampment who are homeless and their families are split up because they're using heroin and everything else.
I agree.
And here's a guy
you.
Who's making a living,
bringing up kids,
and bringing up kids. And why, you know, what is that helping us to get rid of this guy?
But to continue to make excuses and to say, "Oh, Trump was going to focus on criminals,"
he did. They lied.
No, he didn't lie.
No, they're going out and they're actually rounding up people who are law-abiding, safe people.
And going out against the criminals. But the policy change is a policy change. That's not focusing on
anybody. The policy change is a lie. The policy change contradicts what they said.
He didn't say they changed the policy
that they're going to send back these people who have been following the law and are productive citizens.
No, that's wrong.
They said we're just going after the violent guys.
You read into his statement. He never said that. He said he would change the policy.
Who's on the air with John Vileka?
and by the way, before I leave, I just want to say, just like my president, I'm a big fan of the police. I'm a big fan.
All right.
Except me.
He's a fan of you too. And I'm a fan of Harry Droz and John Vileka. Thank you, John Vileka and Harry Droz, for coming on Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.